listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
G'day and welcome along to episode 73, part A of the Howie Games. Hopefully you are having a great week and this episode puts a little smile on your dial. There's no greater prize in English or Australian cricket than the Ashes. It's the ultimate contest steeped in history, tradition and passion. And now a little history lesson for you. From 1989, Australia was on a streak of tremendous success. For 15 beautiful years across 8 wonderful series, the Aussies dominated the English. Then in 2005, a team stacked with superstars, including Gilchrist, who was on episode 1 of the Howie Games, Ponting, episode 20, Hayden, McGrath, Warne, episode 63, Langer, episode 53, Martin, episode 16, Lee, Clark, episode 11, and Gillespie arrived in England to make it 9 straight series wins. But they didn't. England, led by this week's guest, Michael Vaughan, triumphed in one of the greatest cricket series ever staged.
Mystery. What is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
This is Michael's story, told by a great storyteller. Vaughan is a very, very funny chap. As a commentator, he has few peers with his ability to explain the game, relate to the audience, and make listeners laugh. As a cricketer, he was a gun bat and a fine leader of men. Enormous thanks in this episode, by the way, go to commentary genius Anthony Hudson, a man whose brilliant words add context to the story you're about to hear. And if you haven't already, make sure you check out the new fancy Podcast One app. They have nailed it no matter what type of device you listen on. So check out the new Podcast One app.
You can do it if you try, try, try. If you try, try, try.
Now, as well as telling his story, in this ep, Michael also explains in detail how England did the unthinkable in 2005 and won the Ashes, defeating a mighty, mighty team. Enjoy Michael Vaughan, OBE.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know mystery. What is to be revealed in King Selassie I? Come on, children, trot with me. We want to reach Mount Zion I.
Welcome to the Howie Games. The great man, Michael Vaughan. How are you, Vaughan?
Yeah, very good. This is the podcast that everyone talks about.
Thank you.
I'll see how good you are when... Well, I've finished in an hour or so, but
give
this
me a
is
score
the one.
At the end.
And this actually travels to the UK. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Howie Games, actually, people in the UK have that little podcast app on the phone.
Yep.
I think they put it on late at night, you know, when they're trying to get a snooze.
To sleep. Yeah. There I was, you were being all positive for me.
But I think that's more down to the guests. And
yeah.
You know, that'd be a perfect kind of tablet at night to just make you go to sleep nicely.
Well, I've been reading your book, aptly titled Time to Declare, and that's been sending me to sleep at night. Just before we get stuck into it, your book... Great book, terrible title. Come on, Vaughan. You could. That's a cricket clear. Time to declare. Did you come up with the name of the book?
No, I actually wanted to call it Manchester Born Yorkshire Cricketer.
Right.
They didn't want that.
No.
It's the publisher. The title. Look at Warnies. Warnies is called No Spin.
Yeah, nearly as bad.
Yeah, I think the.
Warnies should have been Horny Warnie, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, yeah. I think that would have gone down. Absolutely perfectly.
Well,
yeah, the title. Look, the title's not me. It's boring. It's
time
not me.
To declare.
Yeah, it's boring. I did another couple of books. I did one called Calling the Shots. I mean, that's even worse.
It's been a big summer. This will probably go to air prior to the Ashes, I think. But we're sitting here in South Yarra at the moment, just looking over the big apartment complex that's being built here.
Yeah, it's nice. Just been down the showroom, actually, and the girl. Oh, yeah. I said, what about the big one at the top? And she says, oh, it's 25 mil. I was like, phew. So I just looked her in the eye. I said, yeah, but I want a big one. You know, I want one like that can be put together. Can we put two together with a face? She said, what, you serious? I went, yeah, I want really big. I want like 8 bedrooms. I said, I'm on a joking, love.
Your folks' contract is obviously different to mine. How have you found it? It's been... I think it's the way broadcasting is going, that we don't just need locals in the local area for test matches.
Yeah, well, I think cricket is a global game. You know, with you're looking at all these T20 leagues around the world. We all know more about every player around the world now because we see them more often.
Yeah.
You go back 15, 20 years, we'd see players every now and again in a test or a one day. But because of all these leagues around the world now, we're all commenting, you know, in social media, we're all kind of actively making comment on pretty much every player in the world. So I think it's the right way for broadcast to go. You know, we've had it in the UK. Michael Holding's been over for many years. Warney comes and does pretty much all the series. You look at Tony Gregg over here for Channel 9 for many years. And I think it's good to have commentators that aren't emotionally attached to teams. You know, I've been with England for pretty much 20-odd years as a player and a broadcaster. And particularly the last 10 years as a broadcaster, and you are emotionally tied to them.
Of course, sure.
You know, you arrive on the morning of the mat and you're nervous for them. But of course, you've got to give an honest assessment and you have to say what you see. You can't be a broadcaster if you're not going to give that opinion. But I've really enjoyed being out here just watching cricket and just watching the game and trying to make comment on the game without that emotional attachment to any of the teams. I just like watching good cricket. I like watching people fight. I like watching players come through difficult times. I like watching skill.
What's the difference between broadcasting in England and broadcasting in Australia? Is there one?
I think there's a slight difference. I think over here, I'd say it's a little bit more relaxed. You know, I think, and I think it suits my style more here. I just think there's quite a bit of ego and has to be in sport and has to be in broadcast as well. And I would say of what I've found, there's not as much ego here as there is back home in the UK.
Why? In what way?
I just think there's a lot of competition around the world and I think there's a lot of competition here. But I've been amazed of how well, you know, you're looking at Fox and Seven, there's two big stations broadcasting the game. There's a lot of commentators, there's a lot of production staff, there's a lot of directors on the show at the games. And I just don't know if that'd work in the UK. You know, BT took the cricket off Sky for the Ashes and, you know, it was uproar. And I just can't see how that kind of relationship would work in the UK. Well, we'll find out next year because the BBC are broadcasting some of the new 100 ball competition with Sky. So that'll be interesting to see how that goes. But I just think over here there's a general love for cricket because it's the number one sport. It's the only real national sport. And throughout the time that cricket's on, there's no other sport. So you do feel that you're right at the pinnacle of people's front rooms. And you know, back home in the UK, I think we're competing with so many sports all year round. You're looking at rugby leagues played through our summer. Pretty much every summer, there's either an Olympics or a European Championships or a World Cup football. Wimbledon's at the heart of our test match kind of start season against the what you call the better team or the most profile side in the summer. So I would say it's great to be here just talking about a sport that pretty much you feel that everyone's watching. You know, you feel that when you've said something or done something on the television or you've made a comment, you're going to a pub and someone will just say, oh, I heard you yesterday, you muppet.
Yeah.
Didn't agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't done that much live TV in England, but I don't think that happens as much. You know, there's so much more on at the same time. And that's why I enjoy it. I mean, obviously, I enjoy the weather as well. The weather's pretty good and golf courses are nice and the beers are all right as well and the wine. So, no, I've really enjoyed it. I've you know, hope to be back over the next few years.
I'm sure you will be. You've met my two kids, the Pickle and the Big Penguin, who normally come in later in the show. I think you met them up at Spotless Stadium. But that answer you've given me is quite relevant. I haven't seen the kids for 4 days because I've been travelling around in Big Bash games with you. So they actually sent me this morning before going back to school their questions. So you get Sky, the Pickle, right off the top.
Right.
Hi, Vaughnie. Pickle here. I think you sound great on Fox Cricket. Daddy thinks he should be allowed to commentate with his thongs on because he said he'd feel even more relaxed. Do you think that's a good idea?
Pickle, I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yes.
I'm going to go further with the thongs. There's a few little problems in Australia. There's a lot of rules.
Yes.
Lots and lots of rules.
Too
which
many.
I don't quite. The bar shut too early.
Yep.
I don't know why, 10 o'clock. And it's not that, you know, can I have another ring? And they go, no. No, but, you know, we've been here for... No, we're shut. And they just kick you out. I mean, I don't get that.
We've become a society. Rules.
Yeah, I get that. That's not quite in what I would look at an Australian and think, oh, you know, they're all like a little bit of a party. They all like to have a few. And
that's how we used to be. Yeah. We used to rebel against rules in this country.
Too many rules in Australia. And the other big rule is, I know we're talking a little bit of the high echelons of life, but the Qantas Lounge.
Oh,
I know you've been there before, but the thong's not allowed in the Qantas lounge. So I walk in with a pair of thongs. Sorry, Mr. Vaughan, you're not allowed in here. And then a lady walks in with a pair of, you know, sandals on.
Yes.
So I could have said, in you come, madam. I mean, what's the difference?
Your man, Kevin Peterson, blew up big time on social media
last
year.
Well, so he should, and I get that.
But he wasn't allowed in.
Should be allowed in. I mean, in Australia, it's boiling hot. You're wearing a pair of thongs, and as you should be allowed on commentary.
Yes.
I like Mark. I saw Mark Bosnich work at Fox just the other day in the studio, and he's behind the desk with his suit, and he looks immaculate.
Yep.
But what people don't know, he's got shorts and thongs on under that desk.
But he rolls his own run.
That is what I like to see. So, yeah, Howie and Pickle, I think you should wear the thongs. And particularly when you're doing the roaming around the, you know, around the field.
That's the way forward.
You should have shorts and thongs on.
That's the, well, no, you've come up to my hotel room today with no actual shoes on, and I don't have any on. So we're both sitting here bare feet. You've got your green, healthy juice, and you've been... You've been at F45 this morning?
F45, yeah. I mean, I don't know what's come into me while I've been in Australia.
You've been working hard.
I have, yeah. I mean, I think it's these Big Bash games. It's been good because they've been at night. And the day-night test match, night time, so...
How'd you go in the F45?
By the time you get back to the hotel, everything's shut.
Yeah.
So you can't have a drink. So I reckon I've had the healthiest 4 weeks of my life.
How'd you go this morning?
F45,
yeah. You told me last night you were dreading it.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as the one in... I did one in Cooja with Michael Lum, the Sixes manager, ex-England player, and that was sick. I'm not going to lie to you. I had to walk out the back. There was a bowling green, and it needed a... I wouldn't say it was the most pristine piece of grass, but it was a lot worse by the time I'd finished with
right.
it. Just gave it a little bit of a splatter.
That is the best bowling club in Australia, though, overlooking Cooja. All right, we'll go back to the start with you, which is a bit incongruous sitting here in the sunshine in Australia, but you grew up Lancashire?
Yeah, Manchester. Right. Yeah, I was born in Salford. And then I moved to Sheffield with my dad's job when I was eight or nine. I got run over in Manchester.
Run over?
Yeah, nearly. I fractured my skull. So
At what age?
Seven. I was on my budgie bike and I'd gone to play some football or cricket with my brother and a friend, and we kind of were coming back, and I got on my budgie bike and went across this road, and this car flew, smashed me in the air, fractured my leg in about Ooh. Four places, fractured my skull. And I was put against this tree, and obviously the traffic stops, and I didn't know at the time, obviously I'm a kid, but my granny and grandpa were in the traffic, and they didn't know it was me on the tree, just sat there, blood all over me.
You're kidding?
No. So I was in hospital for about 6 weeks, Hope Hospital, and this is where my love of cricket came, because I had to watch television, and cricket was on the TV. And I always remember my dad was a big, you know, he played in the local leagues, he was a captain of the third 11 at Worsley Cricket Club where we lived. And he was a big cricket fan and watched and went and watched a lot of the test matches. And in his business, they used to sponsor and help out beneficiaries. And for whatever reason, he put an advert in David Bairstow's testimonial magazine. And then one day in hospital, I always remember it, he arrived with St. Peter's the Bat. Real old fashioned.
Oh, the SP?
Man.
Yeah,
SP.
Yeah, I know the SP.
Signed by David Bairstow.
Right.
To Michael, best wishes. Get well soon.
Johnny Bairstow's father.
Yeah, yeah. So that was my first love. And I always remember, you know, I've got a picture. It's in the book of me in my wheelchair.
Yeah.
With my leg up in a pot with my
With your
my
SP.
FP, yeah.
There you go.
So that's where my real... I mean, I enjoyed cricket when I was a kid, but I was mad on football. I absolutely... I'm obsessed with football. And I don't make... And I'm dead on it. I would love to have been a footballer.
Did you play footy as
Yeah,
as
I was
kid?
At Sheffield Wednesday for a while, but... I wasn't quite good enough.
So at what age were you with there? Which is the club you love and support?
Oh, yeah,
now?
I love them, yeah. I mean, and it was because my dad's company sponsored the away end. Unfortunately, you know, the Hillsborough disaster, the end that the disaster happened was my father's company on the roof.
Right.
The sponsored Presto Tools. And the chairman of the company was the chairman of Sheffield Wednesday. So when we moved over to Sheffield, we just kind of was at Sheffield Wednesday all the time. And we could, and I was an 8 or 9 year old running amok. You know, I could go in the dressing rooms, could run around wherever I wanted. It was incredible times. And, you know, we used to always go down there. So my love of football was huge. My brother was more into cricket. My brother was a good cricketer, 2 years older. And when we moved to Sheffield, we were close to the cricket club where... You know, I came through and Joe Root has come through, Sheffield Collegiate, Aberdale Park, where Yorkshire played some county matches every year. And we'd always bunk off school and nip through the hedge to make sure we could watch. and it was around probably 10, 11 when my brother was playing for the under 12, 13s, that I went down to the Nets and we had a great coach down there called Jack Bethel, old school. Like, never praise you. You know, even if you've got runs, he'd say, okay, get some more next week. Proper blunt Yorkshire, but a brilliant coach. Really, really good technical coach and really instilled the disciplines of batting. And I netted for a few weeks and he then said, you're going to go up to Yorkshire for a trial. And I'd only played like two games. And I said, what? He said, no, you're going to go to Woodhouse Grove School. You're going to go to the Yorkshire under-11s trials. Anyway, mum drove me up. And it was in those days where you had to put, like, we had one jumper, one white, like, woolly cricket sweater. And if you play for different teams, you had Velcro on the front of your sweater and you changed the badge.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, and I had Sheffield Schools, like, because I played a couple of games in Sheffield Schools. Basically, in Sheffield, if you were one of 11 players, you weren't going to get picked. You know, there was only 11 of us that played in the city, so you're going to get the team. And I went up to Woodhouse Grove and had this trial. It was an afternoon trial. I got in. So I'd only played a few. I was in the Yorkshire under-11s team.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I've never played more than really a 20-over game, and this was now going to be time cricket. I have 3.5 hours in the field. So that was where it all started to get, not serious, but my mind started to trigger, oh, wait a minute, I could be pretty good at this. I was never, ever the best at that age, ever.
Were you not?
No.
So you weren't a Ricky Ponting?
No. No, I used to bowl outswing. I used to charge in and bowl outswingers.
Did you now?
Yeah, I'm back, you know, 5 or 6. But what happened at the club is they really pushed me. You know, they saw I could play a bit and they started playing me. Because my brother was in the 13s, I'd rock up, you know, like a little kid and think, oh, if someone doesn't turn up, I'm in. And every game, there's always someone. So I ended up playing above, you know, 3 or 4 years. And then from around 13, they just threw me into the men's stuff. And we were so lucky because it was a county ground. We had great nets. We had really good facilities, grass nets. We had a really good pitch. And I was playing from the age of 13, 14 in a first team that had 4 or 5 minor county players. And then we had Ian Bishop as an overseas pro.
Your team?
Yep. Kenny Benjamin as an overseas pro. So I'm on a Tuesday, Thursday night as a 13, 14 or facing those two in the nets.
You're facing Ian Bishop?
Yeah, I'm in the nets at Aberdale Park facing those guys.
No.
Yeah, and that is my... I say to this day that that's when I started to develop as a cricketer, and that's the only way that you can get better is getting thrown in.
What if you're 13 or 14, Ian Bishop, who I've had the pleasure of commentating with, big, kind-hearted soul, but when he was bowling, he nearly killed Justin Langer here in his first test match in Adelaide. How hard was he going to a 13, 14-year-old Michael Vaughan?
He was swinging him away, but he wasn't, you know, trying to hurt me. And he was coming back from that back injury, so he wasn't what he was before. I mean, I saw him bowl for Derbyshire against, I think it was Yorkshire at Chesterfield, and I've never seen anyone bowl that quick.
Wow.
And it was a bit of a dodgy wicket, and he was flying through. And then when we had Kenny Benjamin was the coolest guy. I think we had him for 2 years. He just slept. Yeah. He just slept all day. And then he bowled. And then he slept. And then he went out. And then he slept.
So what was going on in your life? You're going through school at this stage.
School.
What were you like as a student? Well, you thinking I want to play sport for a living or no?
No, I think I was. I mean, it's hard to kind of remember, but I just love sport.
Mm.
You know, everything about my school life. So every project I did was sport.
Ugh.
You know, so I remember in woodwork and we had to make something and I made a cricket bat knocker inner.
Like a mallet type thing.
Yeah. The teacher, what you're going to, I draw it like a football stadium.
Okay.
You know, everything in my life was just geared to sport. You know, listening to the radio late at night, you know, and just kind of turning the TV on with mum not hearing so I could walk midweek soccer special at 10:30 on a Wednesday night to get the games. And, you know, I just used to idolise sports people. You know, I'd get every magazine, the Match magazine, that's a football magazine, the cricketer would arrive. I knew exactly when it would arrive. I'd get excited that it was the first week of the month and you knew the cricketer was going to come through the door. And if it didn't arrive on a Monday, I was like, where is it? Tuesday, I'd be down there making sure that it was still there. And when the equipment brochure comes out for the following year. Oh,
with
I used to circle every bat or pair of gloves or new bag that I'd try and ask mum to try and get hold of. And I remember saving up to get my first bat.
What did you get?
It was a Gunnamore striker. and I got the bus into town, Sug Sports in Sheffield, and got my Sug Sports strike. It was £11.50. And then a year later, I saved up, and there was an old guy in Elland in Yorkshire, and he ran a company called Ace of Elland, and he made his own bats. And I travelled up with my dad to go and have my own bat made, and I've still got it.
You've still got the bat?
Yeah, Ace of Elland, yeah. And it was £13.50.
Wow.
Yeah, this willow bat that was handcrafted in front of me. £13.50, like a toothpick. Don't want to use it now, but no, it's still that. That first bat is probably, I mean, I'm very fortunate to have a collection of the Legends bats. You know, Callis has given me a bat, Sachin, Brian Lara, Ricky, Freddie Flintoff Peterson, Mike Atherton. You know, I've kind of collected bats along the way.
Where do you keep them?
They're in a room at the house.
Right.
They're not on the wall. You know, I've moved house recently, and I think the wife got sick of looking at cricket stuff. And I kind of get it.
If your beautiful wife said, right, you've got to throw all those bats out except one.
I'd keep the one I got made.
Right. Chuck out Lara's bat.
Because that first bat, I think, especially the first one you get made, and it's for me. You know, it was a size for me at that time, and there's more memories in that bat than there is in the Legends bats I've got, because they're just great. They're pieces of memorabilia, and you know, I'm sure my little boy will love those in time. And I look at them and feel very honoured and privileged that I actually walked onto a cricket field with those guys. But that first bat, no one can take that away from me.
A lot of people in this part of the world won't understand, and I didn't realise till I read Time to Declare. I understood the rivalry between Lancashire and Yorkshire, but a lot of people won't. Just tell me about that and Yorkshire's policy prior to you coming on the scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as big now, I don't think, but back in the day,
yeah,
man, you're talking of sellout crowds. You know, 30, 40,000 going to watch the Roses clashes back in the 60s, 70s. And, you know, I made my debut against Lancashire in 94. And I reckon there was probably 10 to 11,000 there.
But you were playing for Yorkshire.
Yeah, I was. And
but you were a lad from Lancashire.
Yeah, that was interesting around the time I was playing for Yorkshire Boys, because I knew I couldn't play for Yorkshire. So I played for the Yorkshire 11s.
Why couldn't you
12,
play for them?
Because you had to be born in the county.
Right.
So around my years of 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, I knew I was playing for a team that I couldn't play for. But full credit to Yorkshire, because I was obviously schooling in Yorkshire. It was Yorkshire Schoolboys. They just picked what they felt was the best team. But I was trialling and netting at Northants. So my mum and dad would drive me down to Northants on a Saturday or a Sunday. I went to Lancashire. Lancashire could have signed me, because at around 15, at that time you could sign like schoolboy forms, and Lancashire could have signed me. And I got very lucky in a way that there was a coach at Yorkshire called Steve Oldham, and Doug Padgett, my old kind of coach that was with me all my career. And we had a chief exec called Chris Hassel, who was from Lancashire and had worked at Lancashire, now was working for Yorkshire. And they looked at the way that I'd been developed through Yorkshire cricket. You know, I'd played pretty much all my cricket in Yorkshire. I might have played a kind of plastic ball game in Manchester. I might have played a bit in the garden with my brother, but all my cricket was developed in Yorkshire. And they just came to me one day, I think it was around 15, and I was starting to play well. I'd started to be moved up the order. I got my opportunity when I was 14 to bat at three. The number that I was generally at seven, playing for Yorkshire Boys. It was the first game of the season. Might have been the 15s, actually. And the coach, Mr. Steen, just comes to me and says, oh, I can't remember the kid's name, but he'd not turned up. And rather than move everyone up, Mr. Steen just went, Vaughan, you bat three today. And I got 99. So he just kept me at three. And I got, I think, 1,100 runs that summer. It was the Daily Telegraph Young Cricketer of the Year. Mike Gatting gave me a bat at Lord's.
Huh.
And that was because of that one chance, that opportunity. I still look back at that day and think, if I'd not moved to number three, where would I be? Because that was really when I went to a different level. And it was around then that Yorkshire started to go, wait a minute, we've got a kid here that's done so well for us. We don't want to lose him. So they had to go through committees, votes, and they bent over backwards to allow me to sign.
The first
ever.
Englishman, not from Yorkshire.
I was the first to put my name on a piece of paper, yeah.
Was it a big deal then?
Yeah, it was huge. There was a big press conference. But
press conference?
There was an announcement that I was signed, then there was going to be a Yeah, I was 50. I did a press conference at Sheffield Aberdale Park with the chief exec and the coach
at
of the club
age?
And the captain, Martin Moxon. 15, 16.
Oh, I wish I could get my hands on
that. Yeah, it was bad. Blazer on, I always remember it. It was my own club when Yorkshire were playing there. And I think around that time, Yorkshire had signed Craig McDermott. So they changed the policy. So I was the first to put my name on a piece of paper, but for the academy position. Then Craig McDermott signed. Craig McDermott got injured. And then we got someone called Sachin Tendulkar. So Sachin became the first. And then we signed someone called Richard Stent, a left-arm spinner from Worcestershire, who was not born in the county. But I am renowned in Yorkshire for the one that triggered it.
Wow.
I was the one that kind of put my name. And, you know, it was hard at the time. I remember when I was 12, I was playing at Aberdale Park, and the first team, Yorkshire, were there. And I was playing in front of the dressing room down below. They were on the balcony. And I was hitting a windball, you know, the orange windball, with my mates. And it had rained, so it was skidding off. And we're playing for like 14 yards, and the bouncers were coming, and we're ducking and weaving. And Doug Padgett was on the balcony watching. And Peter Hartley, who I ended up playing with on my debut and played for a number of years, and he's now an umpire, was watching over with the wicketkeeper, Richard Blakey. And I don't know until a few years later, but they said, oh, this kid can play. So anyway, Doug Padgett came down, and he came and said, youngster, can I have a word? And I said, yes, of course you can. He says, can I have your number? I said, yeah. He said, your name? I said, Michael. He said, no. I said, there's my number. He said, right, I'll be giving your dad a ring. I said, okay. Anyway, about 2 weeks later, I'm sat in the front room, the phone goes, and I could hear my dad in the kitchen. And he goes, yeah, it is Mr. Vaughan. And it was Joe Lister, the secretary at the time of Yorkshire. And I could hear the conversation. I go, Michael, he was batting, yep. Doug Padgett got, yep, that's the one, yep. And then my dad goes, quiet. And then he walks in. I said, Dad, what happened there? He said, oh, bizarre. Joe Lister, the secretary of Yorkshire, was on the phone asking about you. And then it just the last question, he said, can I just ask, Michael was born in Yorkshire, wasn't he? And my dad had gone, no. He slammed the phone down. Phone slammed down, gone.
So you eventually started playing for Yorkshire, and I loved reading in your book about the life of a county pro, but involved in Yorkshire at the time, you're talking about Sachin, yeah. Richie Richardson.
Oh, Richie Rich, yeah.
Did you spend much time with Richie Rich? You used to and from games.
Yeah, he used to pick me up in his massive maroon Mercedes. Yeah,
Richie did.
Yeah, Richie Rich. Yeah, mine was like the E500 back in the. It was massive, and I used to sit in the front, and we used to just travel and talk. He used to always wear his Oakleys. He'd wear his Oakleys driving, in the bars at night, in warm-ups, in the field. I'm sure he slept in them. And I always remember we were travelling back from... We got in trouble, actually, me and Rich, because I used to love his cut shot. So I used to say to him, come on, teach me that cut shot. So every morning in warm-ups, we'd go and just practice the cut shot. And then he was ahead of his time. He used to say, look, you've got to practice left-handed. Don't know where the game will go. So I used to practice left-handed. And Richie's practiced left-handed. We weren't getting many runs at the time. The coach would go... Were you two? Just, what about batting right-handed? Can't get any runs right-handed. But I used to try and play this cut shot all the time, and it got me out on a few occasions, and the coach took me to one side and said, look, you're not Richie Rich. Get over it. Start playing the way that you can play, not like him. But he used to drive mad. We remember coming back from Gloucester, and we'd had a long day in the field, I think. I think we'd lost, or it had been close. Anyway, we're driving back to Sheffield. He's dropping me, and he used to drop me off at Junction 36, and my mum would pick me up. And we're driving up the M1, and he just looked over, he goes, youngster, I'm tired. I said, all right, Rich, not long. He goes, no, I need a kip. I went, all right. So I'm thinking, well, when he gets home, he'll have a kip. M1, three lanes, everyone's going to 85. He pulls in on the hard shoulder. Just pulls in on the hard shoulder. He goes, just 20 minutes. And I'm looking at him go, and I can't say anything to Rich. Rich,
of course you can't.
He just declines his chair. Just go, and these cars are flying by. And I'm looking at him, what do I do here? I mean, this is illegal. You're not allowed to do this. Anyway, 20 minutes later, he goes, that'll do. And he just drove off. Oh, he was great. He was great. He fell asleep. I remember playing at Edgbaston. And you imagine an old-fashioned coach, Doug Padgett. He's like discipline, he's grit. You know, you fight, you watch every ball, you study the game, you worship the game. And all of a sudden, what these overseas pros brought was not the Yorkshire way. The Yorkshire way was that. And Richie Rich was playing at Edgbaston. I always remember he had this And the Harlequin helmet, all the different coloured helmets.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't go down well with Yorkshire. But
I wouldn't have thought so.
Richie Richards got it on. And he's waiting to bat and he's facing, Donald's bowling quick.
Alan Donald's
bowling quick. And the coach, and we'd look, I think I'd gone out for 20 or something, and we're in a tight situation, and he looks in the dressing room, Richie Richards fast asleep. Faster kid, Rich. And the coach said, what is it? It's faster than then all of a sudden, Richie, you're in. Wakes up, walks out of bat, made the most magnificent 80.
Did he?
Ever. And what I found, when he was facing just county players, he was useless. As soon as he came up against Courtney Walsh, Kirtley Ambrose, Alan Donald, lifted his game, Wazim Akram, it was almost like, right, this is what I'm here for. Mm. Facing Tom Noddy's around the county, seeing on little green tops, absolutely useless, Richie. You get him against the pace and the time to show off his cut shot and his pull shot.
And away he went.
Oh, it was a joy to watch, yeah.
Back to Vaughney in a moment. Next up on the Howie Games, coming out on Thursday, August the 15th, is basketball legend Andrew Gaze, a man who I have been trying to get on this show from the very first episode. A welcome to the Howie Games, a man that has no peer in this sport as far as basketball is concerned. Andrew Gaze, hello to you, Gazey.
Well, I appreciate the introduction, but that is not true. There are many, many peers, but very humbled that you would introduce me in that manner.
Can I just say right off the top, and you know I love you, I've got enormous respect and love for
Here
you.
Here comes a whack.
But this podcast has been going for over 2 years, and yes, I've been speaking to your people for over 2 years, trying to get you on, and why has it taken so long? That I thought we were friends, but apparently that doesn't cover this.
Now, you know that's not true.
That is spot on.
Because firstly, I don't have any people. Right. I have me. And I still recall approximately, it would have been 18 months ago.
No.
Gazy, this Friday, we had a chance. Love to. Want to be a part of it. And then Friday, sorry, Gazy, no worries. I can't do it this week. Bit under the pump. Got a few other things I've got to attend to. And then no further correspondence entered into.
A different recommendation and memory from me, because all I got back from your people...
I don't have people.
...is I got an email saying, until this show hits 20 million, it did last week, until it hits 20 million downloads, our man Andrew won't appear. Well, and as soon as the magical number came up, my phone's ringing, Andrew's ready to come on your show.
Well, you're on the front foot here, because I wasn't aware of that fact, and I was actually going to come here and just set the record straight that I feel a little embarrassed, because I thought I'd be a little bit higher up in the pecking order, and here I am, number 75 guest. So we've actually gone through 74 more important people than me.
That is the world's funniest basketballer, Andrew Gaze, coming to you on Thursday, August 15. Alrighty, back to Vaughney.
Was it as much fun as it looks on the outside looking in, being a county pro? Just like we look at it here and those beautiful cricket grounds you play, and you just seem to play so much cricket. Like if you love cricket, you're playing 5-6 days a week, and then one day is on Sundays.
Yeah, it's changed a bit because they play at all the major venues now. We used to play at Harrogate, Middlesbrough, Scarborough. They still play there. Sheffield. You'd play 2 or 3 games at Headingley. Now they play the majority of the games at Headingley. And you go around to like Guildford, Ilford, all these grounds around the country. It was magnificent. But my first week was against Lancashire. So my debut's against Wazim.
Wazim Akram.
Wazim Akram, Peter Martin, Glenn Chappell, Phil De Freitas. Good attack. And it was a beautiful week. And I always remember I arrived at the hotel. We were staying at the Bowden Hotel on the Wednesday night. I'd been playing for the England under-19s, and I got the call up in the dressing room at Trent Bridge from the coach. Rings the dressing room, no mobiles. Vaughan, you're in the first team this week. I was like, all right, better ring my mum. She's got to drop me off. So mum drops me off at the Bowden Hotel, strolling with my bags. I'm rooming with Peter Hartley. So you're rooming with player. I'm rooming with the senior pro. So I arrive at around 6. I go, Pete, what's happening? He goes, in the bar. I was like, all right, that's what happens. It goes down. I must have had 3 or 4 pints the night before. That was the norm. Went to bed, slept okay, went to the ground, win the toss, we're batting. I went in first with Martin Moxon, got 64, got peppered by Wazim, got hit everywhere. Addison's at first slip, Fairbrother the second slip, Warren Hegg behind the with the gloves on, and I got peppered. And the physio had to stay on the side of the pitch, like just beyond the boundary ropes, because I kept on hitting on the hand, on the arm. It was rapid pitch, it was bouncy, and Wazim just peppered me. Got away with it, got 60-odd, and played quite nicely. that night's career best. So I had to go buy all the lads a drink. I always remember TGI Fridays on the way back. Went to the Bowden Hotel, a couple more, Fountain Bar in Hale Village. You know, I think it's in the book. Got lucky. You know, got lucky.
It is in the book.
Right, actually. Friday, went out to field, mid-afternoon. I always remember it. The skipper comes up to me and goes, "Young'un, off the pitch, go and ask their team where the best pubs are tonight." I was like, "Seriously?" He went, "Yeah, off you go."
So in the middle of the game.
Yeah, so I said to the ump, "Oh, I just need a piss." Off the pitch, upstairs is the Lancashire dressing room. We're downstairs. I walk up the dressing room, up the stairs, knock on the dressing room door. About 3:30 in the afternoon, Wazzy Makram opens the door with a piece of paper. I went, "Cheers, Waz. What's that?" He said, "I know what you're coming for. There you go. Piece of paper with a list of pubs. Put it in my pocket." Downstairs, onto the pitch, ran straight up to the skipper, went, "Skip, there you go, piece of paper." And everyone must have thought that the skipper, because there was a bit on the television, must have thought that the skipper's had some tactics sent out to the pitch. He just had a list of pubs. So we went to a few of those pubs the second day, got lucky again. We're playing well in the game. We got a good score. Goffey bowled magnificent. It was around that time that Goffey started reverse swinging the ball. Richie Richardson had made Goffey into the bowler.
Right.
Richie had sat him down one day and said, "What are you being a medium pace? Bowl quick. Bowl quick, hit the stumps." Just changed him overnight. And he bowled reverse swing, bowled him out. Second innings got 28, got a bit of pepper in again. That was the days when you'd play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday was Sunday league. So Saturday night was what you call a Saturday night club. So team gathering. We all had to get our togas on.
No.
Yeah. Me and Richie Richardson walking through the hotel at Bowden with a toga on.
Toga party.
Barry Wood. Remember the
yes.
Ex-Lancashire, England opening batsman? He came because he was friends with the coach, Steve Oldham, at the time. And he joined the toga party and did all these drinking games. I was sick in the corner. And then went back into the village of Hale. Got lucky again. So I'm 3-3. Team's on top. And I don't think I'm playing the next day because, you know, I'm a young kid. I've been picked for the four-day stuff. But Richie did his thing, so I'm playing. I'm playing in front of 16,000 at Old Trafford on the Sunday. Could hardly see. Fielded down. They just say, "Young, you're down in the silly corner in front of all their idiots." Just they gave me a barrage for like 2 hours in the field. Dropped a catch. I think I got about 6 runs. Sunday night we went back. Was a bit tired. Didn't get lucky on the Sunday. Went back on the Monday. Goffey bowled him out. We won the game. And I remember my dad couldn't come because he was working. Mum had been there. And Dad rings me up and he said, "How was it?" I said, "Dad," I said, "you'd never believe this." I said, "It's like a stag do, but you've got to play cricket." I said, "I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. This is ridiculous." He says, "Well, enjoy it as long as it lasts." He said, "Because I think you've made the right career choice."
So somehow through all that, mate, you managed to make runs. Time goes on. We don't have all day to digress into too many innings, which is a shame for me. But you made your test debut against South Africa.
Yep.
What's it like for the first time when you walk out onto a ground with the England Lions as you guys have them on?
It's scary. I mean, this test debut, I remember Nass coming up to me and said, "What's important about test week is you'll see the senior pros change. You know, warm-up weeks is about just getting your eyes in and just getting your movements right. Test week, they switch on, they're different." So particularly on the morning of the match, just study others. Study, you know, Stewie. Just study the likes of, you know, Mark Butcher, these players that have played a bit. Just see what they do. So I went, "Okay." I said, "What, before the match?" I said, "No, when we go out to bat, just trying to get an eye of what they're going to be about." I went, "Cool." Anyway, we lose the toss. It's a bit miserly in Joburg. And before I'm at 2 for 2. First over.
Not much chance to study those
blokes. I've not had a chance to look at them. Strolled out there 2 for 2, non-strikers end. Before I faced the ball, we're 2 for 4.
Which in, so you're 4 out for 2 runs?
Yeah, yeah. But, so we Chris Adams is strolling in at 6. And I always remember Grizzly coming up to me and goes, mate, what's it doing? I remember looking at him and going, "I don't think you're going to go far in this game, Chris. I haven't faced the ball yet. I've got no clue." Yeah, we got, and this is how times have changed. I think I got 34. It was zipping around. Donald was bowling quickly. It was, you know, it was a pitch that was doing all sorts. Pollock was bowling nicely as well. Hansi Cronje was playing. He bowled a few, actually. I don't know why he bowled a few. He bowled a few swingers. And I was like the saviour of English cricket because I scored 34. 34. Freddie Flintoff got 36. Me and Freddie put on a few runs. And it was like, these two are going to save English cricket. I was like, what? We've only got like a small amount of runs, but that's where English cricket was back then. You know, we were in the doldrums. We really were, and we got hammered on that trip. We got beat heavenly. We only ended up losing 2-1, but we were like battered. You know, we were never in any of the contests, and then we won the last game because, you know, it's now common knowledge it was a fix. You know, the game had to be a result. That last day, Hansi Cronje needed a result, had to be a win or a loss, and, you know, I got 76, got man of the match. Didn't get any leather jackets.
Pulled away by Garth for four, and England win the fifth test match of this five test series, set up by a declaration earlier in the day, and then two innings forfeited. But what wonderful entertainment there's been.
Well, that was...
Did you have any idea?
No, I mean, we all just felt, because it rained so much. South Africa had batted and it rained so much, and there was a lot of England supporters out there, probably 5,000 or 6,000. And you got to the last day, they'd won the series, and it just felt the right thing to be doing. You know, give the crowd that had turned up a chance to watch a contest rather than just watch test match cricket for just watching test match cricket. It just seemed to me that it was the right thing to do. Unfortunately, and I would say it'd be the right thing to do now, but because that happened, I think it kind of gets people talking too much if it happens again. And I just think, you know, you go to county cricket, it happens. You set up a game on the last day, if you've had rain, you go into 3-day second 11 cricket, it happens. You know, but because it happened in test match cricket and it's been since known that it was a fix, you know, I think it's kind of changed the way people look at the game, which is unfortunate.
You've played a lot of cricket. You've seen a lot of cricketers. You've seen possibly the greatest test innings of all time when a chap made 400. 400, Vaughan, for BC Lara.
The cleverest man that I played with was Ashley Giles. He arrived on that first morning and he was sick. And Gareth Batty had to play.
Right.
And poor old Gareth. I mean, we had him out on naught. He was caught behind
Lara.
On naught, he was out. Caught behind. DRS would have... On your way, Brian.
What, little edge?
Steve Harmison, feather through to the keeper, not out.
No.
Not out.
And he went on and made 400.
I mean, talk about, you know, making your kind of cost for a mistake, but he was out.
Good delivery. Harmison celebrating, the keeper and the slips are celebrating, but no one else is moving. The one thing certainly that has not moved is Daryl Hare's hand.
Same with the kid Scott, who was keeping for Durham back in the day when I think Chris Scott, I think his name was, he was keeping behind the stumps and he dropped Brian Lara when he was playing for Warwickshire on, I think, about 30 or 40. And I don't know if he was in the slips, but someone said, oh, hope you don't make your count, cost that, you know, hope you don't go on and get 100. Well, he got 500. 501.
So how's a test match progressing out in the field when Lara brings up 100? And then 200, and then 300.
Oh, we wanted him to get it.
Right.
We were like, come on. Because it was batting that, you know, such a long period of time, we kind of knew he was taking time out of the game, and we were 3-0 up in the series. And I just felt sorry for Gareth Batty because we tried everything, and he just toyed us. So Gareth said, come on, bring me down up. Just try and get him to do something. As soon as he brought me down, he just whacked it over his head for six. Put me down back, he'd just knock it for ones, and every like third or fourth, come on, let's just try mid off, dance down, whack him into the stands for six. I mean, he was a freak.
There goes the sweep, there it is. Perhaps the most significant single ever in the history of Test match cricket. Brian Charles Lara becomes the first man in the history of the game to register a score of 400.
He was the one player. And I was fortunate to captain against a lot of the greats, you know, Ricky Ponting, Sachin, great, great players. But Brian Lara was the only player that I thought took the piss out of me as a captain.
Wow.
Out in the field. It was at the Oval, 2004. And we were 3-0, we're hammering the West Indies. And throughout that series, we'd done nicely against him. We kind of kept him quiet. And then it was at the Oval that, again, we were on top, but he went out to bat. And we'd try 7-2 offside field, and he'd just take the piss. He'd just use his wrist and get it onto the onside. And then we'd go straight and try and get him hitting through the offside, and he'd just do that. He just took the piss out of me. Wherever I created a gap, he just hit it into the gap. And I kept on looking at him going, there's only a small few people can do that. And he was one of them. He was just just that kind of player that you just knew that if he arrived, we played against him in 2001 at Old Trafford, and again, I think the series was about 2-1 at the time. We were winning. We'd gone 1-0 down, then we won 2 on the trot. We'd won at Lords in the title, and then we'd gone the Headingley. We'd bowled him out for 50-odd on the front. 2-day game. We beat him in 2 days. And then we're at Old Trafford. It was Stewie's 100th game, and he hadn't had a great time of it, Laura. And Craig White had got him out a couple of times around his legs, jumping in the air, expecting Shulman firing a straight one on leg stump, bowled him. And then he got out at Headingley a couple of times cheap. And he arrived at Old Trafford, and we said, don't chirp him, don't say anything. I think Dominic Cook got into a bit of a spat with him just pre-lunch. And we're going, Cooker, what are you doing? And he wasn't playing well. He was jumping all over, edging on me, saying, just say nothing. He's not going to get any. And I always remember as we walked off at lunch to Old Trafford to get in the dressing rooms, we go up the stairs. And as we went up the stairs, I just out of the corner of my eye noticed Laura. I went, where's he going? He came towards the pavilion and then turned left and walked straight to the nets. And as it was Channel 4 back in the day, and they did this lunchtime show, and they realised it. So as we were eating our dinner in the dressing room, kept on looking at the TV screen, and they kept on panning into Lara, netting. He netted for the whole 40 minutes. And we're looking at Cooker, what have you done? Look at him. The afternoon he came out and just smashed us all over. Got the best 100 I'd seen. I'm like, Corky, there's a lesson. Keep your gob shut. Never seen him for the whole lunch, just having a few throwdowns and got some of the West Indies to go and have a bowl in.
There's no bigger time for an English cricketer, I guess, in the Ashes. And you came out here and smashed Australia everywhere. And I think you made 600 plus runs in an Ashes in Australia, which was quite extraordinary. But you talk in your book about the lead up to that tour. And I guess you hadn't won an Ashes since 86, 87. And we were just used to absolutely not only beating England, but caning England. Obviously, that had an effect on the senior blokes you were playing with.
Yeah, understandable as well, because the Aussies were that good. But England got close to them in the 90s.
Yeah.
A couple of times they got close. They went 1-0 up at Edgbaston in 1 year. 98, 99 over here, it was close. Could have been quite easily 2-2. There was a run out of Michael Slater in Sydney. Made the Aussies win 3-1. If that decision, it should have gone England's way, it could have been 2-2. That would have been a remarkable result for England when you think about the Aussie team back then.
My word.
So I remember, you know, I'd had a good season in 2002. My first kind of standout season for England, 4 centuries in the summer against Sri Lanka and India. So I remember arriving at the hotel to get on the plane to go to Australia. And I played one-day game against the Aussies, so I'd not really played against them, certainly not played McGrath and Warne. So I'd have a glass of wine, and just me being a bit of a cricket badger, I thought, you know what, I'm going to sit with the senior guys, going to have a chat with them and just see what's up. And after a glass of wine, I just said, come on, give us an indication what happens in Aussie. And they told me a bit about the nightlife. And I said, oh, great, okay, what about the cricket? I said, Brisbane, first test. I said, and they went, well, where do you want to start? And they talked about the crowd, they'll be on you, they'll be spitting on you. I thought, well, that sounds nice. I said, what about the cricketers? I said, no, I presume I'll be opening. I've done all right, you're not going to change that. He goes, yeah, you'll be opening. I said, all right, Glenn McGrath. And the faces and their eyes just kind of peeled out. I was like, all right, who's going to speak about Glenn McGrath? One of the senior guys, you put 1p on a line, he'll just hit it. New ball will be swinging away at 85 miles an hour. Every now and again, he nips one back. Top of off stump, there'll be 4 slips, a gully, probably short leg, Justin Lange. He'll be giving you plenty. And by the way, when he bowls his bouncer, it'll be right on the money and it'll be quick. I went, all right. I said, sounds tough. I said, if I manage to survive that spell, it sounds like I won't. Warne comes on, what happens? Another senior guy goes, oh, Jesus, got 15 different deliveries. Hayden comes in at silly point, Ricky on the drive, Steve Waugh's spitting on you, Gilly behind the stumps giving you plenty, Zooters, Hooters, Grooters, Indip, that zipper or that flipper thing that he bowls, it skids off the pitch about 150 miles an hour, traps you on the crease. If McGrath's at the other end, you're probably scoring at 1.5, scoreboard don't move. I remember looking and thinking, what the fuck are we getting on this plane for? I don't quite get that. So I arrived in Australia fresh with no baggage, and I completely understand why they got to that mindset. I really do, because if you're beaten up by something for so long, it just gets embedded in your brain, the negativity. And as much as you try and say, right, this is different, I'm going to be positive, it only takes one mistake or one failure and you're back into that old mindset. So I decided to come out here and have a pop. I really did. I thought, right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to try and give myself a sniff early, try and play sensibly, try and get in, have a look, and then I'm going to take them on. I don't believe you can take on any great players or great teams without attacking them. I just don't think they're great because their disciplines and skills are better than what you've got. So the only way that you can compete against them is try and hit them off the length or hit them out of their mindset. And I did well in a warm-up game at the Allan Border Oval. I smashed their A side for a big 100. And that gave me a belief that, yeah, I can score runs in Australia. The pitch is true. Just got to survive that opening burst. But the nerves of that first game in Brisbane, I'd never had nerves like that. I didn't sleep for 3 days. And I'm a pretty cool character.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't sleep because it was the Ashes. And what really affected me more than anything was the anthems. Because, and people say, well, how can that affect you? Well, you warm up and you go back to the dressing room normally and then you go out and play. But there's almost like another arrival out of the dressing room, you had to go and sing the national anthem. I'd never done that before.
Mm.
And we were in the field and we were shambolic in the field. I dropped a catch. I think I fumbled the ball about the third ball at Gully. Just one straight to me, went straight through my hands. And I was a nervous wreck that first day. I dread to think, if we'd have batted on that first day, I can't think I'd have got anything. You know, my mind was all over the place. And that's what Ashes cricket does for you. You know, it felt so different. I'd played against India, Sri Lanka, the West Indies, Wasim and Wacker, you know, Kirtley and Courtney. But the whole experience of the build-up for the Ashes, it was something that, you know, I'd not ever witnessed or never kind of felt. And it was just a little bit of an insight. But the insight of that first week of nerves, I got 30-odd and then McGrath got dodgy LB in the second. He wouldn't have hit another set. No DRS in them days. But Glenn Lee sending me on my way. I said, not even out. Well, that first week gave me an indication from the first things where I hit a few bounds that you just got to attack them. You had to attack them and just try and get a mindset around the group that, you know, we've got to be really positive and try and take them on.
And what were they like, those blokes, to play against?
Oh, brutal.
Were they?
Steve Waugh was... I learned a lot from Steve Waugh. I didn't speak to him because he didn't speak to you. And you felt really small against them. Because they were that powerful. You know, they were big units anyway. You got Matty Hayden, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, big units, powerful, Bingham Lee, and obviously Warne, he's just got an aura that I think when you play against those kind of teams, I mean, I had to act a lot. You put on a bravado of that, yeah, I belong here. And you look them in the eye, but underneath you think, oh, Jesus Christ, they're good. And they're powerful and they're intimidating. And I say to this day that the build-up for 2005, there was a lot of acting that went on. Because I'd had a good season in 2-2-3, so I knew that you could compete against them, but the only way that you could compete would be aggressive and risky. I don't think you could have beaten that team by playing orthodox traditional cricket. And that's why we made a pact as me, the captain, and the coach, Duncan Fletcher. By 2005, we wanted a fresh set of minds. We wanted a younger set of players, and not necessarily younger. We just wanted minds that had not been affected by the 90s and the early 2000s. And we needed players that could gamble and risk. We needed players that could look Glenn McGrath in the eye and Shane Warne and go, you know what, if you bowl a bad ball, I'm going to crash you. And if you bowl something in my heart, I'm going to be willing to take you on. And if as a team, the Aussies come at you, which they will, we've got to be together. And we're all just going to go at them. Even if we get beaten up, and even if we get embarrassed, we're going to be one unit that goes at them. And that's what we tried to develop over the course of 2004 leading into 2005 with a mindset of fearless. Try and go out there and enjoy playing against Australia, because it's difficult to enjoy playing against that kind of team because you feel that they're on you all the time. So all I would say to the players and the group at the time, let's just see what they're like if we can just put them under pressure. You know, they'll probably be able to withstand, let's be honest, but let's just see. But let's not, by the end of 2005, think, why didn't we just be a bit more risky? And if you think of the first game at Lord's that we lost, it's the first time I gave the team a rollicking in my time. And I don't think I gave them a rollicking ever, really.
Just before we get to that test match, so you're captain at this stage.
Yeah.
You did your big press conference, you're the England captain, it's the biggest job in the country. You phoned home immediately.
I did have a mobile in those days, got the mobile out. I said, Dad, never guess what, but keep it quiet, but NASA's just stood down. I'm going to be the test captain. I was remembering, and he said, I'm on my way to work. He said, shit, they must be struggling. So I started to build a unit that we felt I never felt ultimately confident that we could beat Australia in 05, but I felt we could give them a challenge. We'd won in South Africa the winter before. That was a great win because we'd had a bit of, you know, a bit of turmoil over there. There was lots going off and we won there. And by the time we got to 05, it was like, well, we always get built up. You know, we're like that in England.
There's an enormous build-up for that series.
Big build-up, but there was a bigger build-up because we'd won every test at home in 2004. We'd beat New Zealand West in his 7 tests on the trot, gone to South Africa, won. You know, we beat Bangladesh easily. I actually declared against Bangladesh early because I wanted to get to Sheffield Wednesday's cup final. Which no one knew at the time, but yeah, I pulled us in and made sure we won, and I got to Cardiff to see the cup final.
Perfect.
Yeah, you get those privileges as a captain, don't you? Coaches look at me and go, what are you doing? I went, don't worry about it, we'll win. Thinking, I hope we do, because if not, I'm going to get absolutely caned for
take
this.
Take the dish.
Yeah, so we go into Ashes with the Ashes series in 05 with all this expectation from the media, and you know, when you get heavily beaten in that first test, that's the first time I gave him a bollocking.
That is the end of Michael Vaughan Part A. Plenty more to come though, so tune in to Part B where Vaughnie looks back at the famous 2005 Ashes series in detail.
And we can do it if we try, try, try. If we try, try, try. If we try, try, try.
Listener.